This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We began our series about inequality in the Baltimore region, the lines between us, 5 weeks ago with a discussion of how the federal government began redlining in the 30s by defining neighborhoods where African Americans lived as too unstable for lenders to make mortgages. Today we go deeper into the federal government's role with a new report from the nonprofit investigative news outlet ProPublica. This week it published Living Apart, How the Government Betrayed a Landmark Civil Rights Law. The landmark civil rights law in question is the Fair Housing Act of 1968. The betrayal, for which the article lays out evidence, is that the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development failed over the course of four decades to, quote, use its authority to promote integrated housing, close quote. Journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones wrote the report, which is available online and as an e-book with extra features. She has just walked across the Brooklyn Bridge to join us from ProPublica in Lower Manhattan. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for taking the effort to join us.
No problem.
Your article focuses on a particular provision of the Fair Housing Act of 1968, the section that directs the federal government to take an active role in desegregating American housing. What does it say, and what is your interpretation of what it requires the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to do?
Well, the provision that I write about is, it's known as the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing. And in the actual law, it calls on the government to affirmatively further the provisions of the act. So the way that it's been interpreted in the courts, as well as by most scholars, and as well as the first HUD secretary to enforce the law, was that that meant that the government was supposed to not just prevent discrimination, but actively work to dismantle the segregation that it had played such a key role in creating. And the way that the government was to do that was to use its purse, basically all of the grant monies that it supplies to more than 1,200 communities across the country, to use that as kind of both a carrot and a stick to open up housing.
Well, what are cities and counties doing that keep housing from being integrated? What are they doing that needs dismantling?
Well, there's many different practices. I think the kind of major thing is the prevention of affordable housing and kind of rental property in affluent white parts of town, or as is the case in many communities where many suburbs will prevent this type of housing. So you'll have high concentrations of African Americans and Latinos in the cities, but the kind of nicer suburbs, the more affluent suburbs, remain very white. And a lot of that has to do with zoning that keeps out certain types of housing that tends to be affordable to large percentages of African Americans and Latinos.
Can you give me some examples?
Yes. Yeah, so a lot of communities fight any type of subsidized housing. And many communities zone in a way that it prevents any type of multifamily housing, which by virtue of putting a lot of units on one piece of land makes housing more affordable. And then you have many communities that also use kind of large lot zoning where you can only build housing on an acre or larger lots, or sometimes 2 acre or larger lots. And what this does is that it drives up the cost of real estate. They'll also only allow for zoning for single-family homes.
And you mentioned the power of the purse. What kind of funding does HUD give to cities and counties? What could it be withholding?
So I focus on the Community Development Block Grant, and that's one of HUD's longest-running programs, and it's its largest grant program. It basically was created in 1974. It consolidated a bunch of smaller grant programs like urban renewal, different kind of sewer and development grants. And in 1974, it became an entitlement grant, which means that communities are automatically receiving this money based on a formula. And what they have to do is they have to certify that they're complying with the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which says that any entities that receive federal dollars cannot discriminate, as well as the 1968 Civil Rights Act, which is the Fair Housing Act. So they have to certify that they're affirmatively furthering fair housing to receive this money. But the issue is, which I reported, is that HUD doesn't really check for compliance. And in the last more than 30 years, HUD has only taken money away or withheld this grant money from communities twice, and both of those instances were in the Obama administration.
Why don't you tell us what those instances have been?
Okay. So they withheld money from Westchester County, New York, which was the site of a landmark fair housing lawsuit and settlement in 2009. And Westchester was basically accused of defrauding the federal government by signing, you know, hundreds of certifications saying it was affirmatively furthering fair housing when it actually refused to even acknowledge or study the impact of race or segregation. So the county settled that lawsuit, and since then has been kind of an ongoing dispute with the federal government over certain provisions of the settlement. And finally, HUD decided to withhold $13 million in community development block grants. And then the other case is Joliet, Illinois, where the Department of Justice is suing Joliet for trying to get rid of a housing project that's largely African-American. And the Department of Justice has accused Joliet of trying to reduce the number of African-Americans who live in the city.
You lay out the history of the act and how it was rooted in a reaction to the race riots of 1968. Tell us briefly about the showdown between President Richard Nixon and his HUD secretary.
Okay.
Early in the life of this law.
Yes. Yeah, so I was, as I started researching this, everyone kept pointing back to George Romney, who was Mitt Romney's father, mm-hmm. and saying, you know, if you want to find a HUD secretary who actually tried to enforce the act, that's the one that you need to find out more about. And so I went to his archives, which are housed at the University of Michigan, and just began going through his paper and kind of interviewing people about George Romney, and found that he was a man who was kind of deeply influenced by the 1967 Detroit riots, which happened in Michigan when he was governor. And he believed strongly that the segregated communities were the cause of these riots, that African Americans were living in kind of a hopeless situation, and that until America began to break up what he called the white noose around the black inner city, we were going to continue to see this type of violence and despair. So when he came to HUD, he brought that understanding with him, and he decided that he was going to use the Fair Housing Act to kind of dismantle these communities that through zoning and other means had blocked affordable housing and managed to stay segregated. And it did lead to a pretty colossal showdown between him and Richard Nixon. Of course, Richard Nixon ran for office and was elected based on a Southern strategy where he was going to slow down progress on civil rights, and really had banded together a coalition of former Dixiecrats and white suburbanites who were kind of angry about a lot of the civil rights changes. So as George Romney began to press some of these white suburbs to take affordable housing and threatened to cut off federal money if they didn't, as soon as Richard Nixon found out about this, he stopped the program. He stopped meeting with George Romney. He basically took over HUD in terms of saying that George Romney was no longer going to set HUD policy. And eventually George Romney resigned because he couldn't even get a meeting with the president anymore.
That's Nicole Hannah-Jones of the nonprofit news operation ProPublica here on Maryland Morning at 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. She's the author of a new report called Living Apart, How the Government Betrayed a Landmark Civil Rights Law. You single out Maryland's Montgomery County as a jurisdiction that acted independently to create integrated communities. How did that happen?
So it's very interesting. So the same year that the Community Development Act was passed in 1974, which was consolidating this block grant program and really providing this great opportunity for the federal government, because by consolidating all these grants, it gave HUD kind of a single choke point that it could cut off large amounts of money to communities if they weren't moving towards integration. But of course, if the government kind of walked away from that, well, that same year you have Montgomery County, which passed the nation's first Inclusionary Zoning Act. And Montgomery County has seen a very different path than many of your larger suburban counties that abut highly segregated metro areas. Montgomery County is far more integrated than the nation as a whole. And what this Inclusionary Zoning Ordinance did was it said any development of a certain size had to include at least 15% of the units in that development had to be affordable units, so they had to be available to lower or moderate income, either buyers or renters. And what that has meant is that all across the county in the wealthiest pockets, you will find affordable housing, and you'll also find public housing. So they're far more integrated than Washington, D.C., and they're far more integrated than the nation.
But isn't Montgomery County different than most metro areas in its overall affluence and the strength of its economy and the eagerness of developers to build in Montgomery County? Didn't that make them more willing to work with a law that required them to include affordable housing? Could other cities, other counties really have done this?
We ended up looking at Montgomery County because it kind of provided an interesting foil to Westchester County, New York. So Westchester County, New York is also a very affluent county, and both Westchester and Montgomery County are in the top 10 most affluent counties in the United States. But Westchester took a very different path. So I think the fact that it was affluent didn't necessarily mean that it was going to be more amenable to this. Westchester County is also affluent. It's also a very liberal Democratic county, and it also has some of the most exclusionary zoning in the country. So I think that it was definitely a choice. And believe me, when I interviewed people from Montgomery County who were trying to push that law through back in the 70s, it faced a lot of opposition. And this was a county that had also been a Jim Crow county. One of the housing commissioners who really fought for this law said she had to have a police escort at one time. This was not a community that was amenable to this. When they finally passed the ordinance after 6 years of fighting for it, the county executive vetoed the ordinance, and you had the county leaders who were willing and had the political courage to override that veto. So this wasn't a place that wanted this. This was a place where you had some leadership that said, this is the path that we're going to take. It's the right thing to do, and they did it. So, yes, other places, I think, could do that, but I think it's often when it comes to residential segregation, it's hard to find political leadership that's willing to take this on.
Last week in the series, we talked about the Thompson v. HUD lawsuit in Baltimore. The suit alleged that when the high-rise public housing towers came down, former residents were moved to places that were just as poor and segregated as the towers had been. In August, HUD agreed to a settlement that requires more people in public housing, people with housing vouchers, to be moved out to, quote, communities of opportunity, close quote, in the suburbs. How does Thompson v. HUD play into the story of HUD failing to integrate American housing?
Well, I think it shows a couple of things. So HUD was a defendant in this lawsuit, and I think that shows a long history. HUD has, pretty much since the Fair Housing Act was passed, HUD has been fighting lawsuits accusing it of segregating. So you have this agency that on the one hand is charged with enforcing civil rights law, but on the other hand is continuously defending itself against claims that it violates the civil rights law. And I think that really gets to the internal tension at HUD. It really is an agency with very kind of disparate roles. And what's often happened is that fair housing, at least according to the people I've interviewed who've worked at HUD, often has lost out. HUD fought that lawsuit for a very long time, and I talked with an official who worked at HUD during that lawsuit. He came with the Obama administration, and he said, you know, we really pushed the president to settle this suit. You could not have the first black president fighting a suit like this, fighting a desegregation suit. He needed to settle the suit, and then a couple years later, that finally happened. But I think it also gets to kind of the issue of HUD's role and the roles of community in ensuring integration. Because what happened in Baltimore is what's happened in metropolitan areas all across the country is all of the kind of subsidized housing was concentrated in areas that were already poor and already highly minority. And what the Thompson case said is you have to have a regional plan for fair housing. You have to look at how the federal government is spending its dollars within a region, because simply to say we're going to try to spend them in a way that furthers fair housing in a city where many of the white population has left isn't enough, because then that means that suburbs are each coming up with their own individual plans, and what's happening is that African Americans and other people of low income are not having options regionally, which is really how you have to desegregate. And if you don't have a regional plan, you're not going to be able to have true integration.
We asked HUD to speak with us for this program, and we got the same written statement they had sent to you, which reads in part, quote, we do not tolerate violations of our fair housing laws as demonstrated by the thousands of investigations and hundreds of legal actions taken over the last 3 years. In case after case, HUD and the Department of Justice have achieved justice for victims of discrimination, helping to return individuals to their homes, imposing significant monetary penalties against landlords and others who have engaged in discrimination, and increasing community awareness of the rights protected by these laws. Close quote. Mm-hmm. Am I correct that this statement is talking about redress for individuals, and while your report focuses on HUD's responsibility for patterns of housing?
Yes, that's correct. And that's kind of long been a criticism of the agency and really of the reading, how the federal government overall has read the Fair Housing Act. And this really does stem from Nixon. President Nixon said he actually had his staff attorneys look into and come up with a strategy where they could read the Fair Housing Act very narrowly to only address instances of individual discrimination, and to not kind of look at the larger patterns and to deal with the affirmatively furthering. And that's pretty much how HUD has dealt with the Fair Housing Act over its history.
Nicole, thank you.
You're welcome.
Nicole Hannah-Jones is a reporter with ProPublica. We have a link to her report, Living Apart, How the Government Betrayed a Landmark Civil Rights Law, at linesbetweenus.org. More of this interview there, too. George Romney shows up in Hannah-Jones' report as a hero of fair housing. His son Mitt, the Republican nominee for president, has not said much about his plans for HUD, except during that private meeting with donors, where he talked about the now infamous 47%. He said HUD, as we know it, might disappear under a Romney administration. Quote, I'm going to take a lot of departments in Washington and agencies and combine them. Things like housing and urban development, which my dad was head of, that might not be around later. Close quote. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. This is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning.
My name is Lauren Alexander. I'm the oldest daughter of Lucille Gorham.
Lucille Gorham has been a community activist in East Baltimore nearly half a century. She spoke with HUD Secretary George Romney when he came to Baltimore in 1971. WIPR's own C. Fraser Smith described it in his book, William Donald Schaefer, A Political Biography. Smith wrote, quote, Gorham had experience Romney could not fully appreciate. She knew urban renewal from the street. It had decimated three of the neighborhoods where she had lived with her eight children, all born before she was 30. Her neighborhoods were worth preserving, she thought, even though Washington saw them as segregated. Close quote. Lucille Gorham's oldest daughter picked up the story when I went to see her yesterday.
When they wanted to come in, they wanted to move us out to the suburbs, or they just wanted to start building houses. And my mother, she didn't like that. And, you know, she couldn't figure, why would you take us all out of our area and plant us somewhere where we don't know anything about these people? You know, we were fine where we were. We just wanted better housing and all. That's what she was interested in. And that's what she really wanted them to see. And that's when it all started. And that's when we started seeing Schaefer and most of the politicians come in the area. And that's what we found out about urban renewal. Because during that time, nobody had never lived in a brand new house. You know, we were skeptical about it, but we was excited about it, too. Nobody, wasn't too many people in the area owned a house. You know, if we had lived in a community with like 90 people, might have been one person in the area might have owned a house. So, you know, that was a big deal just to have a nice place to live.
I know she's been an activist for than 40 years.
Oh, yeah. She just gave so many East Side people chances to have nice homes. That's what it was, you know, because really, we didn't want to talk to no white folks coming in the area about nothing, you know. They don't know nothing about us. What we need to talk to them for? But, you know, she used to get on everybody. You don't need to think like that. You need to broaden your horizons. And we're going to talk to everybody, and we're going to form our own opinions, but we're going to see what everybody has to say first.
Lorna Alexander saw urban renewal through the eyes of her mother, activist Lucille Gorham. We'll hear more from her in later segments of The Lines Between Us. At linesbetweenus.org, we have details on an event hosted this morning by Baltimore Neighborhoods Incorporated. They'll be talking about what it means to affirmatively further fair housing. Starts in a half hour at the Episcopal Diocesan Center, 4 East University Parkway in Baltimore. I'm Sheila Cast. That's it for The Lines Between Us today. Later on Maryland Morning, Tom Hall talks to the biographer of Elizabeth Patterson Bonaparte, Baltimore's 19th century proto-celebrity. Stay with us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus. Or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.